This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, now that summer has truly taken us into her embrace, we've been thinking of some of our favorite summer pleasures. And it was fairly unanimous. One of the sweetest times of summer is lounging around in the sun, maybe on a beach, maybe your favorite spot on your back porch or your yard, and in your hands is a good book. Well, that's the cue to welcome Keith Taylor back to Stateside. Keith coordinates the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. He is a poet, he's a writer, and he is simply the best at uncovering hidden gems for us to read and enjoy. Welcome back, Keith Taylor.
It's good to be here, Cindy. Thanks.
So what have you brought us for our summer reading?
Well, I did a quirky list. There's those summer reading lists that everybody does, and there's an awful lot of overlap on them.
Yeah.
This year, there's a particular bunch of overlap. NPR list is the same as the New York Times list, which is the same as the AnnArbor.com list, or very close. So I thought I'd find some things that were a little bit different, a little bit out there. They're not going to fit everybody's image of a summer read, but some of them will appeal to some people, and I think those books will become important to those people.
Starting with
Matt Bell's In the House Upon the Dirt, Between the Lake and the Woods.
Well, first of all, the title is wonderful.
A 12-word title. I think every beginning writer is told not to do that, but Matt Bell breaks the rules. As that title indicates, there's something about this book that is much more myth than anything we might easily label reality. Here the author is making some demands on the reader, and many readers, you know, particularly in July, might not want to submit to those demands. You don't read this book to escape.
Yeah.
Those readers who get there, those readers who are hooked, and they'll probably be hooked by the first page, they'd be drawn into this strange dreamscape where neither the characters nor the locations have names. People build their houses by singing them into existence, and outside are damaged bears haunting the night and living deep in caves where even the people must go to survive. Hmm. Animals transform into people and people into animals.
This sounds like Game of Thrones.
It does a little bit. It does a little bit, except Game of Thrones is more realistic than this one.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a stretch.
I'm thinking of the wargs.
Right. Matt Bell has constructed his dreamscape where everything feels like metaphor, although the readers, or at least this reader, is never quite actually sure what the metaphor is meant to describe. There's certainly something about childlessness and the effects of infertility on a couple that desperately wants children. That's there.
Okay.
But there's also this meditation on memory, how it works, and how it generates language. And there's something about our relationship with nature itself.
It does sound like one of the most complex books that you've ever shared with us.
I think it might be. It might be. You got to make some demands. But again, I don't want to use the word there will be a cult following on this book, but I'm going to bet. Huh. I'll bet you that there will be. The right readers are going to relish absolutely every word of it. But listen to this. It's early on where the narrator first sees the bear. The day before I carried my wife into our house, the other reason she was in my arms, the first time I spied the bear watching me from within its woods. And when I saw it, I stilled my work upon the dirt, moved slowly to set down the tools with which I'd not quite completed the house. At the tree line that marked the edge of the woods, the giant bear's back hackled, increased its size again, and the wedge of its head swayed huge and square from its massive shoulders. Its mouth spilling yellowed teeth and lolling tongue, exhalations steaming the morning chill. In the face of its stare, I stared back, and the bear slavered in response, shook its thick fur as welcome or warning, and when it saw it had my attention, it stood on its huge hind legs, its stamping body, a dark tower opening to push a roar up toward the heavens, toward the sun that in those days still ran full circle. Imagine that while you're sitting late at night in your cabin alone by the woods.
Drawing the curtains.
That's right. Yeah, it's not easy stuff.
And tell us a little about Matt Bell.
Matt Bell, he's a Michigan boy, actually. Mm-hmm. Two of my authors this time are Michigan people. Matt's a young writer. He's written a collection of short stories and one even odder novella, which I liked quite a bit. He's from a little town outside Saginaw. Hemlock, I think, is the town he's from. Matt is an incredible presence on the internet. He has in many ways created his life on the internet. He's the editor of a wonderful online journal called The Collagist, thecollagist.com, and he's now teaching at Northern Michigan University. So he's really created a life for himself doing this very quirky fiction.
When you say the right reader, who is the right reader for this?
Who is the right reader for this? This is a reader who is going to enjoy books by Samuel Beckett, who's going to enjoy books by Italo Calvino, books that are built on dreamscapes, books that create their own landscapes.
Okay.
And there's a lot of those people out there. Beckett won the Nobel, after all.
Sure.
But it's not the usual thing we think of. It's not a John le Carré page-turner for the summer, although I love John le Carré page-turners, but this is different.
And the title again is?
Oh, these wonderful 12 words. In the house upon the dirt between the lake and the woods.
That's our first choice.
That's
from Keith Taylor.
Now, the second one's quite a bit different, still kind of odd, but very different in mood. Amy Leach's The Things That Are. If you have to categorize this book, you can categorize it simply as a collection of nature essays. And in many ways, that explanation is right. Amy Leach looks closely at the things of this world: peas, whirligig, beetles, moths, lilies, or goats, among a host of other things. And she learns a lot about them. And then she communicates what she has learned. So that says one thing about the book, but it doesn't capture the flavor of Things That Are. Amy Leach has an imagination that transforms things, and she finds words and phrases that change them too. When I read some of the words she uses, I assumed I was finding even more gaps in my faulty education until I tried to look them up, and they weren't there either. Often these words she invents are very funny. Often they seem to capture something essential. She can indeed be funny, but she can also be quietly kind of wise. And she's a young woman. This is a first book. The world becomes a metaphor in these essays, a way to understand connections and emotional states we might not be able to understand otherwise. So I just want to give you a flavor. This is the very end of a really beautiful essay called The Wine of Astonishment. It starts out being an essay about whirligig beetles moving across the surface of a pond.
Okay.
Near the end, she describes the things that sink into the mud during winter. As summer approaches, these creatures rise to the surface. There's one more thing to consider in identifying a creature, and that is the season. Some of the animals in the mud belong in the mud. Some are just holding their horses. Best to wait until the vernal equinox to decide who someone is. After sun crosses equator and rain softens ground and warmth splinters ice and impassiveness, and up from the mud bed swim the shiny black beetles, up through the murky pond and onto its gleaming surface. Turning ice into water is like turning water into wine. After that many months of mud, whirling on the starry-eyed water must feel like drinking the wine of astonishment.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that pretty?
Yes, it is. It's very, very pretty. Very pretty. So these are essays?
These are essays, and they often start out about one thing and end up being about something else. She does a way she projects herself into the minds of these critters, whirligig beetles, which seem like that's going to be terribly hokey.
Mm.
But that last sentence.
Well, when I think of Van Morrow Lindbergh.
Exactly. Same kind of thing. That tradition.
Yeah. The Gifts from the Sea. All right. Where you're studying shells and
good
seeing.
Job. Yes.
Oh, thank
yes.
you.
It's a beautiful book. And it's a little obscure. It's from an obscure press called Milkweed, or a more obscure press called Milkweed Editions from Minneapolis. I didn't know about it. A friend wanted me to read it. His name is Ray McDaniel. He's a wonderful poet. He wanted me to read it so badly that he bought me a copy.
Well, that means he did.
You know, and now, he was right.
What do you know about Amy Leach?
Not much. I think, although there's so much northern stuff in here, that she must be the northern Midwest somewhere. Did an MFA in nonfiction at the University of Iowa. Has a young child, and that's almost all I know. She's won some big awards for people before the book came out, so she's on her way.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we are exploring a summer reading list put together by our friend Keith Taylor. He is a poet and a writer, and we have him every season to kind of find some uncovered gems for us to enjoy and read. So we've gone through Matt Bell's In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods, Amy Leach's The Things That Are, and now we move on to
A Constellation of Vital Phenomena by Anthony Mara. another lovely title, isn't it?
Yes. It's,
this actually comes from a medical book. So I think, if I remember it correctly, where it pops up in the novel, that's the definition of life,
okay.
A constellation of vital phenomena.
Wow.
This book actually does appear on a couple of other summer reading lists. It is closer to the kind of book one expects on a summer reading list.
Okay.
It's a first novel. Again, a young author. He worked a decade on this book. And it's really interesting. Until the attacks at the Boston Marathon, I think most of us probably never thought much about that little region in southern Russia known as Chechnya.
Correct.
The Chechens themselves think of it as a country, and that's the problem they have to deal with. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, most of them wanted autonomy, but the Russians weren't going to allow that. Mm-hmm. I think it's a necessary place to carry oil from one part to the other.
There's a good economic reason they wouldn't let it go, yes.
So two brutal wars followed, one in 1994 and the other in 2004. Millions of people were displaced, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands killed in that particularly brutal way we seem to have mastered recently in our ethnic wars.
Yes.
People waited for the knock on the door and then disappeared forever. Mm-hmm. Now, Anthony Mara is a young man, and he did his study abroad in Russia, where he was overwhelmed with news about the Chechen wars. Then he spent several years researching them, went to Chechnya, and then he spent all of his time writing his novel. He created a little village outside the city of Volchansk, which I'd never heard of and had to look up. That one's real. And he populated his village with the people who've survived for much of the Second War. Friends have learned to mistrust friends, and people have learned to commit the worst of betrayals just so they can survive.
Mm.
Still, one man, Ahmed, chooses to risk his own well-being, even his life, to protect Hava, the young daughter of his vanished friend and neighbor. He enlists the unwitting help of Sonia, the last Russian doctor in the city. So Mara's blending all these different ethnicities, too, which is interesting. Together, these three small people find a way to survive the horrors around them. I can't say that they triumph, but perhaps survival itself is enough. Mara's great at describing the place and the devastation and creates genuinely vivid characters. I was completely drawn in and was left rather wonderfully devastated at the end. If you feel the need to read for a good cry, your cathartic cry.
Oh, boy. This
book
is the one, huh?
This will do it. Here's a little point near the end of the book, actually. So listen to how well he describes the scene, just in two tiny short paragraphs. Here's Sonia, the doctor, walking through the blasted streets with the little girl, making a tentative move toward hope. A half hour later, they left the hospital. Block after block passed unchanged, but for the location of craters, the dispersion of brick. A one-way sign pointed to the sky. Three emaciated black dogs watched them from across the canyon of a grocery store basement, and thankfully didn't follow. All through it, Sonia's head hummed. She held the girl's suitcase in one hand and her hand in the other. She tried to remember the name of the street she had lived on. This is what there is. Scorch marks fanning like massive seashells across the ground, clouds gathering at the horizon, the unevenness of earth, the small heat she holds in her hand, a hand that is her hand, holding a hand that is the girl's hand. This is it.
Ooh.
This is the kind of thing we can get from novels. We can get our history lessons from novels
yes.
when they're done and when they're done well. And maybe that's a way we need to do it, to connect empathetically with these people who are out there who are experiencing things that we're not feeling.
Oh,
exactly. Yes, and we're drawn in. Anthony Mara, M-A-R-R-A, A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. Wonderful young writer. We're going to hear a lot from him, I think.
And next up.
Next up, I wanted to end with one poem. I always like to end with a poem. Last year, the United States Post Office had some commemorative stamps of 20th century poets. There were 10 poets on there. I don't want to sound too regionally chauvinistic, but two of those poets were from Michigan.
We love that.
Exactly. One was Theodore Retke, who we talked about in the spring.
Yes.
The other one was Robert Hayden. Hayden is maybe a little bit less well-known now. He was born in Detroit in 1913. He studied at Wayne State and then at U of M. Most of his professional life was at Fisk University, and then he returned to the University of Michigan for the last 10 years of his life. He died in 1980, buried out in the northeast corner of Ann Arbor. Hayden wrote many things, And often about African-American history. He has extraordinary poems about the slave trade, Frederick Douglass, and Nat Turner. But some of his loveliest poems are memories of the African-American neighborhood called Paradise Valley in Detroit, where he grew up. Here's a summer memory. The old poet looks back at Detroit circa 1920 and remembers his boyhood, some of the good, some of the bad. The title calls up that phrase from the Gershwin song, Summertime and the Living is Easy.
Yes, yes.
But the Hayden title is just Summertime and the Living, dot, dot, dot. So here's a poem. Here's Robert Hayden, Summertime and the Living. Nobody planted roses, he recalls, but sunflowers gangled there sometimes, tough-stalked and bold, and like the vivid children there unplanned. Their circus poster horses curveted in trees of heaven above the quarrels and shattered glass, and he was bareback rider of them all. No roses there in summer, oh, never roses, except when people died, and no vacations for his elders, so harshened after each unrelenting day that they were shouting angry. But summer was, they said, the poor folks' time of year. And he remembers how they would sit on the broken steps amid the fevered tossings of the dusk, the dark, wafting hearsay with funeral parlor fans or making evening solemn by their quietness. Feels their mosaic eyes upon him, though the florist roses that only sorrow could afford long since have bidden them Godspeed. Oh, summer, summer, summertime. Then grim street preachers shook their tambourines and Bibles in the face of tolerant wickedness. Then Elks parades and big, splendiferous Jack Johnson in his diamond limousine set the ghetto burgeoning with fantasies of Ethiopia spreading her gorgeous wings.
Well, beautiful.
Robert Hayden. His collected poems is just, there's a new edition of it out in paperback. So
very, very good. Yeah. What do you think, Keith, that the books you've chosen, what does it say to you about what summertime in Michigan means?
Oh, boy. What summertime in Michigan means to me, I mean, I usually spend the summers up north, although not this year. I canoe, I walk in the woods, I do all those things, and that these books are, in other than the Amy Leach book, these books are a contrast to that, which is interesting. And maybe that says more about me than it says about the season. But I was looking for the contrast. I have a lot of time, and I have more time in the summer. I can read some of these things that might be more difficult to read when I'm working 15-hour days or have hour commutes. Maybe that's why I like this particular kind of book that makes puts some demands on me. And I know I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone. I know there are people who save their summers for the hardest books on their list. Not that these books are hard. These books are all pretty engaging. But
with great demands come.
They make demands.
Great rewards.
Exactly. Sometimes. Let's hope.
Oh, let's hope. Poet and writer Keith Taylor, he coordinates the undergrad program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. And get the fall reading list ready.
Okay.
Keith, we will
see
you for our fall list.
I'll do it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.